This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, why women are moving out, not up, in science. In the movie North Country, a story based on a real class action suit filed in Eveleth, Minnesota, the women who entered the iron mines experienced constant harassment, discrimination, and bullying. They were pioneers in a workplace where few women had been before, and they opened the door for more women to follow. But you'll probably never see a film about what's going on today with women in laboratories, engineering firms, and high-tech computer companies. Because although a new study reveals an alarming brain drain, it's been much more subtle than the attention that a class action lawsuit receives. Researchers at the Center for Work-Life Policy found that although more women are entering science and technology fields, many of them are opting out in their late 30s and early 40s. Why? Well, the reasons aren't all that much different from what those women miners experienced in Eveleth. In fact, the founder of the center recently told the New York Times, it's almost a time warp. All of the predatory and demeaning and discriminatory stuff that went on in workplaces in 20, 30 years ago is alive and well in these professions. Today, we're going to find out why. What is it about these fields, engineering, medical lab research, computer technology, that's resisted the changes going on in other places? Why did women consistently report harassment and hostility at the job? And what's it going to take to change it? We're going to ask our guest here in a moment. But I also want to hear from you, our listeners. If you're a woman who chose a career in the sciences, whether it's in engineering, high-tech computer work, have you experienced what we're talking about this morning? Is there harassment, even discrimination in your workplace? What did you do about it? And what should more companies do about it? So we'd like to hear from you on that. And if you're a man who chose these fields, you're in a workplace like this, we'd like to hear from you, too, about your opinion on this. Do you think this is true? 800-242-2828 as we begin our conversation this morning. In the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. 800-242-2828. In the metro area, 651-227-6000. Again, listening or calling out to women here this morning who have chosen careers in the sciences, in engineering, in computer tech firms, in research labs, who may have experienced some of what we're talking about this morning. And if you're a man in these fields, be curious to hear about your perception of this. All right, to our guest now. Laura Sherbin is director of research at the Center for Work-Life Policy. She's co-author of their recent study titled The Athena Factor, Reversing the Brain Drain in Science, Engineering, and Technology. And she's with us this morning from New York City. And Laura, good to have you on the program.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
A bit later in the program, Cynthia Norton is going to be with us. She's a professor of biology and women's studies at St. Kate's. So, Laura, I have to admit that I would expect more of this in blue-collar jobs, but I would not expect this in fields where you have to get an advanced education. And maybe that's just a bias that I have that doesn't really make sense. I was surprised to see these numbers. Were you?
We were absolutely surprised. You know, talking to a lot of women through our focus groups, we knew that there were certainly some startling things happened, but we had no idea just the depth of the problems that women face in these fields.
Let's talk about some of the specific numbers and reports that came in from women. 52% of women, your study found, drop out of science, engineering, and technology careers, and they're making these choices, what, in their late 30s and early 40s? Why?
Well, we find that women in their late 30s and early 40s actually face a perfect storm. And this is about the time that they face some serious career hurdles. It's the time that they're moving from the vice president to director level in their career, and they really need to step up their job responsibilities and their performance in order to make that jump. But it's also the time that for many women, home pressures really ramp up. So it's really this perfect storm, this bringing together of pressures that cause most women to recalibrate and eventually drop out of the SET labor force.
Some of the women that responded to the study actually gave you details about the discrimination, some of the bullying that and the harassment that they experienced on the job. And your founder called that a time warp. I think that's the thing that stands out most for me out of the study. Give me a sense about what some of the women were saying.
Absolutely, and we found that it certainly is a time warp. You know, these women tell us that there's really some locker room language. The men that they work with, one woman said, you know, I can only hope that my son never behaves that way. Some of the things that are said, are it's just not a very inclusive environment. You know, we heard a few women tell us in a focus group that they actually will do what they call a whistle check before they leave for work in the morning.
What does that mean?
They'll stand in front of their mirror, and they'll check what they're wearing, and they'll make sure on the shop floor in an engineering company that none of the workers will actually whistle at them. And that's something that you really don't expect women nowadays to have to worry about.
I mean, the fact is that I think, as your founder, Sylvia Hewlett, says, mm-hmm. this is the kind of behavior that laws were put in place to outlaw, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, when this was much more common in other workplaces. Why are these fields lagging, you know, in this kind of evolution?
Well, I think that one of the predominant reasons is really just that it still is a very male-dominated field. And without what we call that critical mass of women to actually change the culture down at the local level in the workplace, we just haven't seen that shift. In our survey, we did ask women how many women managers were at their company, and we found a significant difference in the experiences of women working in companies that were not even female-dominated, just had that critical mass of women in the management to shift that culture.
What was the difference that you found?
They were strikingly less isolated. They were less likely to report all of the negative aspects of the culture, including the sexual harassment that was so disturbing that we found. They were also much more likely to say that they could advance and that they saw a true career path for themselves.
I think that isolation factor is an interesting one, too. You found in the study that women in these fields don't have mentors, feel very isolated at the workplace itself, and really don't feel like there's any path for advancement because there's no one to go to make the case, right?
Exactly. And we found this is really particularly troubling for women, you know. They have made it through all of these educational hurdles, and so many of them will tell us, you know, I'm used to there only being a few women in the classroom with me. You know, it's not so terrible that I have to walk up a floor or two to find a female restroom. But when you don't have any other women really on your side and fighting for you, serving as a role model, showing you how to get ahead, it can really stall your career advancement.
I want to go to some calls here. We're going a little early, but we're hearing from some women, I think, who have experienced this. If you're listening in this morning, Laura Sherbin is our guest for the first part of our conversation. She's director of research at the Center for Work-Life Policy and co-author of a new study that we're talking about today titled The Athena Factor, Reversing the Brain Drain in Science, Engineering, and Technology. Essentially, the headline out of this study is that more and more women are choosing to go into careers of science, but at their late 30s and their early 40s, 52% of them are making the decision to get out of science, change jobs, maybe go into jobs that are regarded as softer science jobs. There's a myriad of reasons for that. Primary among them is the atmosphere in some of these jobs, the discrimination, the harassment that women encounter, also and a sense of isolation and the conflict between the demands of these jobs and a family life. So we're talking about all of that this morning. And I'm asking our listeners, if you've experienced this, if you chose a career in science and you've experienced what this study found and what we're talking about this morning, we'd like to hear from you today. 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. I'd also like to know what you think companies should do about it. What should the leaders at the top of these companies be doing to change the atmosphere in these jobs? If you're a man and you work in this field and maybe you've seen some of this, or you don't buy what the study is saying, let us know. 800-242-2828, 651 227-6000 if you're online today, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question to Mary in St. Paul. Mary, you're first, and it's good to hear from you this morning.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
What'd you want to tell us?
Well, three things, actually. I think that the what women are experiencing in the workplace actually begins in college. When I was studying mechanical engineering, there was adjunct professors that were professionals that would come in and teach a part of a class or some of the classes, and they didn't often know even how to coach women to do the normal things in a business world. And what I remember is we were doing a presentation, and this adjunct professor was explaining how we should dress and to do a formal business presentation. And he said to the men, well, you should wear a tie, but you don't need to wear a suit coat. And he was, you know, kind of coaching them through the very specific details of what they should wear. And then he turns to me, and I'm the only woman in the class, and he says, well, you could wear a cocktail dress.
A cocktail dress?
And I was horrified because I knew that a cocktail dress wasn't appropriate. And so the conditioning, I think, starts even before women are out of college. And then in my first engineering job, I really did well. I really moved up. I really succeeded. But once I got married and got pregnant, everything changed.
How so?
Well, I talked to my boss about, after my maternity leave, coming back slowly, coming back at, 20 hours a week and then moving it back up. And he agreed. He thought that would be great. But when it came time to actually making the decision, they actually laid me off.
Wow.
They laid me off when I was 6 months pregnant. The people above him weren't going along with that, weren't thinking that was a good idea. And then after my son was 6 months old, I got another job at a smaller engineering company. Now, the one engineering company was very big, but I was one of the few women engineers. There weren't any others in the location that I was in. The second one was a very small company, and, clearly I was the only woman engineer. And in that company, it was just assumed that you would work 60 or 70 hours a week. And I said, I just can't do that. I've got a young child, and, that's not going to work. And so we had negotiated that I would work 32 hours a week. I would work 4 days a week and have Fridays off. But they always scheduled meetings on Fridays. They always expected me to be there anyway, because there's this expectation that you're supposed to, if you're in engineering, you're supposed to, put in all this time. And there's really very little opportunity to have flex time or, hours that are more manageable. And I think part of it's because there's so many men. It's been so dominated by men for
the years of the career. Mary, hang on one second, because I want to ask Laura to give us her perspective on some of what you're saying. I mean, I hear isolation, hear her being, Mary being the only woman in a lot of these positions, and an inflexibility, Laura, in going along with some of her family concerns. What else?
Well, absolutely. I think that really everything that she said echoes so much of what we hear from other women. So I know you may feel isolated, but you're certainly not alone. And, some of even your stories about it beginning in college, we did a focus group with some PhD students, and we actually learned that their experiences in college and higher education and looking forward into the workforce actually chose them to look for other places of employment and not actually go into the field that they were getting their PhD. So these problems are pretty important even at that level. I think that that's an important point that you brought up. Next, I also think that the flex time point is very salient here. Because
and again, Laura, I hear that and I think companies were coping with this 20 years ago, and in a lot of ways they've figured it out. This does sound like that time warp that your co-founder's talking about.
Oh, absolutely. Flex time is much more prevalent in other fields, and we've heard from so many women who have tried to go on these flex time arrangements. They've making the jump to convince their manager to get behind it and found that it really just didn't work for them, or it made them much more vulnerable to an offshore or a downsize. It put them into a different role, and it's really stalled their career and eventually caused them to opt out.
800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651 227-6000 as we talk about this science out of the Work-Life Policy Center, the research at the Center for Work-Life Policy, I should say. We're talking about this new study that has uncovered what's happening with women in science careers. A lot of women interested going into scientific fields and then finding in their late 30s and 40s that they run into some pretty serious obstacles. We're asking you if you've had this kind of experience, if you disagree with some of what you're hearing from the study, and to share your experience with us. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. We'll get to some of the online questions as well. We have full lines at the moment, but I do want to hear your story and your perspective as well. So be patient with us. We'll get through these calls and get and hear what our listeners have to say, and then I hope we'll hear from you. To Susan in Plymouth. Hi, Susan. You're on Mid-Morning.
Hi, I just wanted to, I can't even believe that you're having this conversation. I mean, it's so cathartic for me, because one of the things that really happens is, this is like, I don't know any other way to compare it, but it's like what happens with rape. You think that you cause this sexual discrimination, the sexual harassment, and people around you start treating you like, well, you're isolated, you're the one that brought this on. And I was in the agricultural research field for 15 years, and I left around the age of 45 because of it, and it ended up in a 3-year lawsuit with the University of Minnesota, which I won on the basis of sexual harassment. And I mean, it changed my life. I mean, I left the field that I loved, and again, I just felt like I was the only one this was happening to, and the only person I could relate to was Anita Hill, because I can hardly believe this is still going on, you know, 10 years later from the time I left. And I left in the mid-90s, and I was so surprised the University of Minnesota hadn't developed training mm-hmm. in sexual discrimination sensitivity.
And Susan, that's one of the – actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the things I want to ask Laura about. What do you find about how aware the leadership in some of these companies and these workplaces are about what the women scientists are experiencing?
I think that gradually the leadership is becoming more and more aware, and we certainly hope that this study sheds a lot more light on the topic. But oftentimes the problem is they really just don't know, and they don't know how to retain and advance and really nurture their female talent. So what we are really hoping to do is shed a lot of light on this topic, because we think that the desire by companies is there to help women. Oftentimes they don't know the right steps to take.
Online here from Al in New Brighton. Are these just certain sizes and kinds of companies? I don't see this at all where I work at 3M, but then nearly half of my lab department is female. Again, that reinforces, Laura, what I think your study found, which is this is not, you're not seeing a lot of these issues that we're talking about this morning in places where there are more women working, right?
Absolutely. Women managers, and especially once they've reached that critical mass, and it sounds like 50% is really well over that critical mass, can really shift the entire culture of the workplace. So I think that he's certainly in a very special situation, and it's unfortunate that not more women can find themselves in that situation.
I also wonder if you think this means that it is incumbent on more women in these situations where, again, they might be a few among the rest of the workplace, to draw attention to these kinds of issues, you know, at the upper levels. And I know that takes a certain amount of bravery and courage, but, you know, aren't women going to have to step up to make changes here?
I do think that it is very important for women to really step up and make change. And so many of the women that we've worked through the course of this research are really pioneers in that. They've stepped up and single-handedly joined some women together and founded a women's network at their company that has been so powerful for the other women there. And even if it's not in person because the plants are dispersed, just having that support network and even the virtual meetings can be incredibly helpful to
us.
It really
is. is, it's really a simple, I mean, that sounds fairly simple to found a women's network. What else?
You know, also really just looking down below you. You know, you may have risen through the ranks and it may have been easy for you, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be easy for every woman below you. So look below you and find a woman to groom or a few women to mentor and really show them the ranks, show them how to rise up when they're hitting that critical point of the, you know, 35 to 45 age range. Really talk to them about some of the things that got you over that hump.
Cynthia Norton, by the way, is going to join our conversation here a bit later. She's a professor of biology and women's studies at St. Kate's. She has an interesting perspective on what it was like to be a grad student, a PhD student in a laboratory, and the decisions that she made from that experience. Quick comment here online from Joe in Minneapolis says, my significant other is a tech manager at a large local university, and she feels a lack of regard and respect from her all-male peers. Did you hear about that, Laura, from the women in the focus groups and who responded to the research?
We certainly did. Lack of recognition seemed to be a very widespread problem for women. They felt like even when they went above and beyond, did something fantastic, there was really no one there to give them just that pat on the back. And sometimes that can really make a tremendous difference. Whereas the men, on the other hand, they seem to have their small posse of supporters and their manager who was on their side, so that they were much more likely to get that recognition that they needed.
Let me go back to the phones here to Kevin in St. Paul. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning.
Your question or comment for us?
I have a comment about the group of people we're talking about being the most competitive men are drawn to these sort of fields, and that they're... that competition breeds a hostile environment for everybody. And the, you know, testosterone-driven boys don't play nice, and this expectation that they should somehow make exceptions to play nice is sort of antithetical to the what draws them to the field in the first place. I think it's also noteworthy that men of the same age group in their late 30s and early 40s are known to be the most unhappy and fed up with their careers and jobs. And, you know, they can't quit. I mean, there's no, you know, it's, they're men, they got to work, so.
Yeah, but they can opt out for a different career, which is what a lot of these women aren't saying, I'm going to get out of the workplace altogether. They're making choices about different kinds of careers. Laura, your thoughts about what Kevin had to say.
Absolutely. Well, I do think that your point about many of these women are really not opting out of the workforce altogether. Only about a fifth of them are. Most of them are really going to much more friendly work environments.
Such as what? Give me an idea of what.
You know, some of these women actually even will just shift into an HR or a marketing function at their company. Some of them go into nonprofit. Some of them will become self-employed. We spoke to one woman who worked in an engineering company who actually opted out of the workforce, took a few years out to be with her children, and then started her own very small company as an architect and found that to be much more rewarding.
Of course, that's not really the answer, though, is it? Because change isn't going to come if a lot of these women are leaving these jobs at, you know, high-tech firms and engineering firms and other science jobs, is it?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's really the crux of the problem here. We do understand that it's certainly a hostile environment for everybody. And we also don't think that all of the time these things are happening on purpose and men are intentionally pushing women out. The important thing to realize here is with all of these talent shortages in these fields, women are really very newly important to employers. And we're not going to solve the talent problem any other way than building a more inclusive environment and keeping the talent that we already have and have already invested in.
I thought the question that goes to what you're talking about that you ask in the summary of the study was interesting. You write, can you imagine the dust-up in the boardroom if 50% of a company's most promising products were abandoned midstream? That would be a big deal in a company.
Absolutely. And, you know, companies, and especially these companies, really nurture their products, especially with the pharmaceutical product pipeline. They nurture their products through many stages of development. And one of the things that we recommend is simply view talent in the same way that you view your product, as a real maker of money, and very closely linked to the bottom line.
And again, these companies have invested a lot of money to train these women and bring them into the workforce and elevate them through positions. It's a big deal when these women say, well, I'm leaving the company in the late 30s, right?
Absolutely. And part of the reason that that time is even more problematic is because that's the time that the investment is the highest in these women. They've made it through so many levels of the company and are already at that important VP or director level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's around the time that once they make it past that hump, they can really start having some rainmaking functions for the company and really recapturing some of that investment. But so many of the women leave at that point that the company's really, it really loses out.
Let me grab another call here before we go to news to Kara in Duluth. Hi, Kara. You're on Mid Morning.
Hi.
What's your experience?
I am a molecular biologist. Mm-hmm. And as a postdoctoral researcher, I had one child at the time, and my supervisor said if I got pregnant again, my career would be over. Then I did get pregnant again with my second child, and
what do you think he meant? Was it a man?
It was a man.
What do you think he meant by that?
I think he meant that there was no way that I could raise two children and have a successful career in science.
Because the time is so demanding, or what?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of the fact that he recognized that as a mother, it just is very demanding to have small children, and I couldn't possibly work the number of hours that was expected.
So what'd you do?
Well, after I told him that I was pregnant, he basically started to avoid me, and he removed resources from my project, and I ended up leaving that position, and I got another position. I'm now a professor, and that's going well. I'm not experiencing discrimination there, but it's extremely hard raising small children and working in a science career.
Right. I actually think, Kara, I hope you'll listen as Cynthia Norton joins us this morning. She had an experience like yours when she was in grad school and chose to become a professor as well at St. Kate's, where she teaches biology and women's studies. So I think she'll echo some of your experience, and I thank you very much for the call. We're going to take a break for news when we come back. Continue our conversation. Laura Sherbin is with us. She's director of research at the Center for Work-Life Policy. She's co-author of their recent study titled The Athena Factor, Reversing the Brain Drain in Science, Engineering, and Technology, talking about the headline, basically, of this study, which finds that 52% of women who go into science fields make a decision in their 30s, early 40s, to get out of those specific jobs that they're in and take softer, in some cases, less demanding jobs. And the reasons for these decisions, that's what we're talking about. Harassment on the job, discrimination, a sense of isolation, a sense that you're not going to progress in the company if you've got some kind of work-life, family balance questions there, talking about all of that. And we're going to break for news, and when we come back, continue our conversation. If you'd like to get in on it, and I hope you will, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can also send in your questions, your own experiences online at minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Send a Question. Back in a moment to the newsroom and Perry Finelli. Good morning, Perry.
Gary, officials in Hugo say many of the access restrictions will be lifted today in the areas hit by Sunday's tornado. City inspectors will be assessing the damage to commercial and agricultural structures. Schools are open today as scheduled. The tornado deaths in Minnesota and Iowa over the weekend bring to about 100 the number killed by U.S. twisters so far this year, and the Weather Service says that's the worst toll in a decade. And the danger isn't over. Tornado season usually peaks in the spring and early summer, and then again in the late fall. A closely watched index finds that U.S. home prices dropped at the sharpest rate in two decades during the first quarter. Stock prices are firm. At the start of a shortened trading week, oil prices are steady. President Bush is headlining two fundraisers in the desert Southwest today. John McCain will only be on hand for one of them, which will be held at a private home in Phoenix. Democratic presidential hopeful Barack Obama is in Nevada as he continues to swing through the desert Southwest this week. He is confident he can be competitive in that area if he secures the nomination. Senator Hillary Clinton will be in Montana. Members of al-Qaeda in Iraq are promising to retaliate against a crackdown in the northern city of Mosul. Iraqi officials say a recent offensive rounded up more than 1,200 suspects. Unless the U.S. Supreme Court or Governor Tim Kaine steps in, a Virginia man will be executed today for killing a convenience store owner in 1998. Kevin Green will be the first person executed in Virginia since 2006. California officials say same-sex couples in some California counties will be able to marry as early as June 14th. That's exactly 30 days after the California Supreme Court ruled that gay marriage should be legal. Weather forecast for Minnesota today, mostly cloudy in the far southwest with a chance of showers, mostly sunny elsewhere. Highs today will range from the mid-50s to low 60s. Right now in the Twin Cities, it's 45. Skies are partly sunny. It's 9:36. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Declare and defend your values. Learn the issues. Fix the federal budget the way you see fit. Minnesota Public Radio News wants to know, how would you spend $3 trillion? Play Budget Hero, a new smart game from American Public Media. Raise or lower taxes, set spending priorities, take decisive action. But be ready to make some tough trade-offs. Can you promote what you value most? Find out with Budget Hero. Visit MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and click on Budget Hero in the Shortcuts menu.
Today's programming is made possible in part by our generous philanthropic partners, including Blandon Foundation, based in Grand Rapids, dedicated to strengthening rural Minnesota communities through its leadership development programs, grants, and public policy initiatives.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up at 10 o'clock, I think this is going to be an interesting conversation, and it launches an election year series. Howard Fineman, Newsweek journalist, commentator, has written a new book called The 13 American Arguments, Enduring Debates That Define and Inspire Our Country. Essentially, what he's done is identify what he thinks are 13 debates, discussions, arguments that really shape the national character. I've chosen six of them. We're going to examine each one separately through the months, through Election Day. And Howard Fineman is going to start us off today. I mean, these are discussions like, what is an American? What do we think of war and diplomacy? How do our ideas shape the national character around those issues? Should be a fun discussion. We've got a special online webpage set up and ready to go. By the way, you can find the link at gather.com. But as this webpage gets going and we have these conversations, we're going to ask you to send in videos and audio and blog about this. And then we'll be weaving some of what you're sharing with us into our conversations as we go through Election Day. So look for the link on the mid-morning page, the gather.com link. Begin to send in your ideas as you hear the show this morning. And then that page is just going to get bigger and bigger, and I'll be directing you to it, and we'll be very curious to hear what you have to say about it. So that's at 10. And then I'm going to be in L.A. for the Book Expo for a few days, and I'll be looking for titles for Talking Volumes and our mid-morning show. And while I'm mentioning Talking Volumes tonight, Michael Ondaatje at the Fitzgerald Theater at 7 o'clock. It would be great to see you in the audience. There are some tickets left, not many, I'm hearing, but if you'd like to be there as I talk with Michael Ondaatje about The English Patient and his new novel, Divisadero, which is just absolutely terrific, you can still get some tickets, and we start at 7 o'clock, and I'd love to look out into the audience and see you there. More information about that online as well at NPR.org. All right, back to our conversation this morning. Lura Sherbin continues with us. She's Director of Research at the Center for Work-Life Policy. And Cynthia Norton joins us now. She's a Professor of Biology and Women's Studies at St. Kate's. And Professor Norton, good to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm nice to be here.
Now, you were in grad school, doing some graduate work for biology, right?
Yes.
And you were experiencing what?
Well, I think, you know, I had a great grad school experience. My major professor actually had had two other women from women's colleges in his lab.
Oh.
So he was very enlightened, and my personal grad school experience was great. But there was certainly sexism. It was really subtle, and it was in the late 70s, early 80s.
What kind of shape would you say it took?
You know, it was this is kind of an embarrassing story, but one of the very first experiences I had as a grad student was a person at the institution who just had kind of sexist things displayed in his office, would come in with T-shirts that were inappropriate. And, you know, it's that kind of subtle thing. I don't know that it was really overt discrimination,
mm-hmm.
but I went to a women's college. And so, you know, I was coming out of this atmosphere where there really wasn't a lot of sexism. And it took me a while to figure out that the kinds of things that I was experiencing were actually sexism, that it was because I was a woman that I wasn't being called on, or, you know, some of the really, you know, what seem like little things, but they sort of eat away at you.
And so after this experience, what, you had to do a lot of lab work in your graduate studies. What, at that point, did you make a decision about which career path you were going to take?
Well, you know, I think the expectation at big research institutions is that you will turn out people like you, that you will turn out people who are going to work in the lab all day long and spend crazy hours. I did a project where I had to be up all night for days and, you know, had little naps here and there. And I sort of knew I couldn't do this. And I don't know if it's particularly because I had in mind, you know, having a family and, you know, maybe having a partner, those kinds of things. But it really was more about my own sanity that it's incredibly demanding.
Is it fair though to say, well, this is what the job requires? I mean, if you want to be an outstanding researcher in your field, this is what it's going to require. And if that doesn't happen to mesh with, you know, time off to have a family, et cetera, then that's just the way it is. Or would you say there are ways that this could be changed so that everybody could be included?
Absolutely. And I think it's true of men and women, that it doesn't matter. I mean, I think men have to have that balance with their families, too. And I think there are a lot of very successful male scientists who probably don't have a lot of time that they spend with their families,
yeah,
because it is very demanding. But I think there has to be ways. And, you know, for me, I love doing the science. I still consider myself a scholar. I still like to publish papers and work in the lab. And the teaching worked well for me, not because it's particularly any less demanding, I think, but it's just a lot more flexible.
And more autonomous, huh?
Yeah, and much more autonomous. You make the decisions yourself about when you're, you know, how you're going to schedule your time. And you know, that age when you're 35, 40s, I had small children then, and that is certainly a time when you start to rethink, wow, what am I doing? Is this really the way I want to spend my life? And I think, you know, I even thought that as an academician, that, you know, are these long hours that I'm putting in really worth it? And I think, you know, I clearly decided they were, but I had such opportunities for flexibility in my schedule.
Laura, I wonder if that pops up in the focus groups and the research that you were doing, this sense of autonomy. I want to be more in control of my own work life.
Absolutely. That's something that so many women tell us would really make the biggest difference in the world. And sometimes it's not even reducing hours or going on a reduced hour schedule, just being able to maybe leave, pick the kids up from school, get them settled with dinner, and then come back online and, you know, work for another 5 hours in the evening. Sometimes it's really just that control that's so important.
Let me go back to the phones here to Regina in St. Paul. Regina, thanks very much for waiting. Tell us about your own experience.
Hi, I hold advanced degree in biology. I have master's degree, and I'm exactly 40 years old. My last job was with UFM, and I had part-time job, 75%, and I was happy about this. Then lab was closed. My PI left, and, you know, they closed the lab.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started looking for job, I found out that I simply can't compete with a PhD and postdoc student that researchers bring now from India and China by dozens and hundreds and thousands, probably. So, you know, you come to interview, you start talking, and your potential boss realize that they have to pay you lots of money, especially in a research lab and your firm, and they would rather take two people on your position instead of you with much less experience than you have. And these people will be literally slave. I am not afraid of this word. Rather than deal with me, that I am 40 years old, I have a family, I have two kids, there are vacations, there are sick leaves.
Right.
You know,
so working around your own family life,
right.
You're finding more and more employers are not interested in that.
Yeah, and you know, I went to one job interview that I really liked it, and then the person who interviewed me, he asked me literally, how many days you were absent last year? You know, I was totally shocked. So how many days you were sick?
Regina, I thank you very much for the call. Some thoughts about this, Cynthia or Laura?
You know, what comes to mind for me is that that if this is true, this attitude of just wanting the people in science who are willing to make these sacrifices and do the work and really do nothing else, you miss so much of the richness of what you could get otherwise. And I think that often it's women who get left behind because traditionally they've been in that family role, they've done that. Men, I think, still earn more than women. and so you make those decisions financially. I think this is true of people of color as well. And what the problem is that you miss the richness of the science, that I think some of the questions don't get asked that could be asked and would be asked by other people. And so I think it's not good for the science.
Online here from Stephanie in Minneapolis, she says when the retirement wave hits, this may not be as much of an issue as most young male engineers see women as equals, even if older co-workers don't. Laura, I wonder if, you know, the demographics will control this and force changes in what we're talking about today, if nothing else does.
I think that that's definitely something to look at, and it's actually the topic of one of our next research projects. We're looking at bookend generations and how Gen Ys and boomers work together in the workplace, but also focusing on how, as boomers are retiring, Gen Y is stepping up and taking some of the roles and really looking to change the culture at these workplaces.
So you're not just focused on science. You're focused on all kinds of workplaces.
Absolutely. Completely across the board. We find that they don't want to work in the same way that their boomer or Gen X counterparts do. And I think that as it changes the culture across the board, it should certainly help in these SET companies.
Now, Professor, what do you tell? You're teaching young women who are, some of whom are presumably choosing careers in science after taking your classes in biology. Are you talking about this at all to these young women?
I'm not sure that we talk so much about discrimination that's out there, but I think what we try to teach our students is, probably they see our example, first of all. We have a lot of us have partners, children, aging parents that we're taking care of. So we are sort of enmeshed in this thing of trying to balance everything. We also have a very diverse group of students, some of whom already have families as they're, you know, and some of whom are older. And so they're already sort of going through this. But I think what we try to do is to also teach them, help them to understand what their potential is and what they can contribute, give them the confidence that they can do this. And I think one of your earlier callers was saying something about the fact that women who are there in the workplace need to do something about it.
Yeah, I was asking about that.
Yeah.
You know, how should women step up to try to make changes in their own company?
And I think that's one of the things we can give these young women is some of the confidence to be able to step up and to talk about science in a social context. We do a lot in our biology classes of sort of critique of science, and not necessarily critique that science is bad, but what kinds of questions have been asked and why are those the questions that are getting asked, and how can you ask the questions that you want to ask, and how do you frame questions,
right.
And how do you look at the science that's been done to critique how those questions have been asked. And for example, not very many people do work on morning sickness. But it happens a lot. And so why weren't those questions asked?
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't questions that have a lot to do with women's health, why weren't they asked?
Right.
So we try to incorporate that, I think, into the classroom and then teach the students really to be scientists in a very active way. And at a women's college, they are the leaders, so they tend to go out there with more confidence, and hopefully will be the ones making some of those changes and taking a leadership role.
I really take your point when you say that you want both men and women in the field asking important questions. And I'm thinking about a show that we did not too long ago about women's heart research and how long, you know, specific research on women, on women's hearts, cardiology lagged,
right,
and how they ultimately discovered that it was very different from the way men experience heart attacks, et cetera. And it made a real difference that more women were coming into the field to push that science.
Right, to ask the question. So there's certainly the numbers factor that you've got to get more women into the fields, but also it's looking at the field itself and how is science masculine or how is science white? What kinds of questions get asked that wouldn't be asked by that might be asked differently by a person of color? I think those kinds of things are where some of the real change can happen, and that's huge cultural change. So that's really hard to do, but I think there are some ways to start looking at the way we ask our questions and how we go about doing things.
Let me grab a quick call here from Aaron in St. Paul. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for waiting. What do you want to tell us?
Well, I'm a mechanical engineer. I operate independently, and I decided to leave my corporate job. And I certainly wouldn't say that I can empathize with people who have been experiencing blatant sexism. It's just appalling. But I think that some of the stories we've heard today just kind of point to how we've elected as a society to work. And
mm-hmm.
I think that what we really need to be doing is really rethinking that. You asked what can corporate leaders do or company leaders do, and I don't have much faith in that. I think they do need to be hiring more women and diversifying their workforce, but I think it's really more important that we as individuals realize that we're much more than what our companies or what our employers tell us we are. And I think that it's important that people realize that if they're not happy with their employer, that they can be happier just doing what they do.
Right.
And maybe leaving and starting their own company or working independently or finding other collaborators. There's more than one way to work than simply being an employee or going through the prescribed academic process.
Aaron, you've touched on something that we're actually going to talk about much more next Monday. We're going to talk about two gals who have written a book about this experiment that went on inside Best Buy, where they created this results-only work environment. And they are saying this whole concept of the way we work has really got to be turned upside down. So for our listeners who are really interested in this, we'll talk about that next Monday. Their new book is called Work Sucks, and there's a lot of people out there that might agree with that. Laura, some thoughts on what we've heard from our callers?
I think that Aaron's point is a very important one right now. You know, what we're finding more and more across the board, not even just in science, engineering, and technology fields, is this traditional model of work that we as society have imposed on ourselves of a white male with a stay-at-home wife.
Yeah.
It's just no longer sustainable. There simply aren't enough of them. And really incorporating a lot of the diverse talent, as Cynthia's been talking about so much, is really more and more important. And it is becoming more and more important to employers. So I do think that some of the onus here should be on the employers and the corporations to really nurture that talent.
And Cynthia, I want to ask you about something that I don't think I asked you when we heard online from, I think it was Stephanie, who was saying, you know, this is going to change because the generation that you have in the classroom right now is going to force this to change, because it won't just be the young women who want flexibility in the workplaces and who are intolerant of this kind of harassment and discrimination. You know, the young men aren't going to put up with that either, and they want more flexibility too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's it is about changing the way we think about work and the way we think about particularly work in these kind of hard sciences, which seems to be that you have to define what's a hard science by how hard you work at it or how particularly objective you are about it. Yeah. And that, you know, there's only a certain way that it can be done. And I guess I don't believe that, that there are probably lots of different ways to do things. And we just have to be a little bit more creative about thinking about these things, because you can, you know, just work. And that's one way to get results. But certainly some of my best thinking happens when I'm doing other things.
A quick online question here from Megan, who in Minneapolis, who says, what do you say to those of us who are just entering the workforce or going back to grad school in science and engineering? So what do you say? Eyes wide open about this, Professor?
Well, absolutely. I guess I would say, and I have a little plug here, but I would say come to our conference. We are, St. Kate's is hosting a conference called Inclusive Science, June 16th, 17th, and 18th.
On campus.
Mm-hmm. We're bringing in some excellent keynote speakers who are going to talk about inclusion in science, how to make change, what's going on with patents in engineering. Sue Rosser is coming to talk about that. And really the main goal is to pull people into one place to address some of these very issues of how we can make science more inclusive and how we can therefore do better science.
All right. We've linked your conference site to our site on the Mid-Morning page.
Oh,
so
excellent.
More
thank
info
you.
For that. And I thank you very much for spending some time with us this morning, Professor.
Thank you.
Cynthia Norton is a professor of biology and women's studies at St. Kate's. Laura Sherbin, thanks so much for the hour. I look forward to hearing what your research comes up with next time around.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me.
Laura Sherbin, Director of Research at the Center for Work-Life Policy and co-author of the recent study titled The Athena Factor, Reversing the Brain Drain in Science, Engineering, and Technology. At 10 o'clock, we are talking with Howard Fineman. He's out with a new book that we've decided to use as a launch for a series, an election year series here. He's come up with 13 arguments that he thinks really shape who we are, the American character. I've chosen 6 of them because we have, you know, 6 months left through the election. So I've chosen 6 that I think will make for some good debates. So each month we'll have a discussion, 1 hour that month, about a specific argument. And then we're asking you to join in on this. Like, one of the arguments, one of the questions, one of the debates is, what is an American? Well, I hope you'll join in on that. I hope you'll think about it. You'll share your thoughts with us on a blog. Maybe you'll record an audio and post it to our site. Maybe you'll record a video and post it to our site. We're going to take some of what we're hearing from our listeners and incorporate it into our show. Now, you'll find the link today on the Mid-Morning page, and you'll see the link for gather.com. But this page is going to grow as we hear more and more from you, and it would be great if you get in on the discussion. Now, a quick note about tonight, Michael Ondaatje, the author of The English Patient, at the Fitzgerald Theater at 7 o'clock. This is our Talking Volumes show. This is really launching our spring season. We have Michael Ondaatje tonight, and then we have Judy Blume on June 12th. And in the meantime, I'm headed out to the Book Expo in L.A. to look for more and more titles and more authors to join us on Mid-Morning and on Talking Volumes. So if you'd like to come to a Talking Volumes, you have a couple opportunities here this spring, and then we'll start the season all over again in September. But it would be really great to see you in the audience tonight. There are some tickets available. Starts at 7 at the Fitz. We'll talk with Michael Ondaatje about writing The English Patient, his terrific, absolutely terrific new novel, Divisadero. And if you'd like to come, still a few tickets left, and I'd love to see you there. This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio.
Support for this program comes from your Twin Cities Saturn retailers, introducing the Outlook crossover with seating for 8 and an EPA-estimated 24 miles per gallon highway. More at thesaturnway.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.